I think the conversation we're having and your podcast listeners need to hear is that they don't feel any democratic presence that addresses their needs or respectfully reaches out to them. When they think of the Democratic Party, they see an absolute silence on issues of social class.
Welcome to Deep Dive with me, Sean Fettig. I'm a political scientist, and I'm interested in how our government and our politicians influence our lives, but also how our personal stories influence our politics. In this podcast, I may focus on topics in the news, but this is not punditry. Instead, I dive deep into issues and stories with my guests, behind the headlines, beyond the basic narrative that is often crafted by the media and our politicians, to help us better understand each other and why we think and feel the ways we do. Okay, listeners, so today I'm embarking on a new deep dive adventure, a mini-series of sorts, and let me tell you why. Being a political scientist and having been a teacher in this area, there are three things I've encountered in the research, both mine and that of others, that posture as warning signs for democracy. First, it was becoming clear that Republican Party voters especially were beginning to design their belief systems around their party identification. Instead of formulating a belief or policy preference and then pursuing a party and/or candidate that held that same preference, Republican voters have been evolving to form their personal policy preferences to align with the Republican Party preferences. Second, in institutional support and legitimacy research, survey respondents are often asked a battery of questions about their feelings toward democratic institutions. One of these questions is some version of the following. If the institution, Congress, the presidency, or the Supreme Court, started making decisions that you don't agree with, or that run against the will of the people, then we should do away with that institution altogether. And what I was finding was that in survey after survey, including my own national survey for my dissertation project, upwards of about 20% of respondents consistently stated that we should do away with democratic institutions under these circumstances. At the time that I was doing this research, a professor in my department scoffed and was indignant that this question was ridiculous and measures nothing real, essentially that nobody would actually do away with these institutions. And 10 years ago, I can understand that sentiment. But today, after the Trump presidency and considering the events of January 6, 2021, I'd like to suggest that maybe not so ridiculous after all. And third, when I was teaching American politics, I would often engage students in a thought experiment, a discussion about the American constitutional design, and really try to peel back some layers to get at this question. What is actually stopping bad actors from bringing down the House, from destroying our government? And the knee-jerk answer is always checks and balances, separation of powers. You know, the president can veto bad legislation. The Supreme Court can find something unconstitutional if it infringes on a right. Congress can take that jurisdiction away from the court if it oversteps its bounds. Congress cannot take rights away from the states, but the states also have to abide by constitutional congressional legislation. And this all sounds good on paper, literally on animal skin parchment paper, which, if you don't know, trivia, the Constitution is written on. But what happens if any actor or actors ignore or flout those rules, those norms, those laws? Donald Trump is challenging these things all over the place. Little Trump bombs everywhere. And really what he's doing is exposing every fucking vulnerability in the Constitution that can bring the country to its end. And he has a massive pool of supporters amongst the American electorate. So taken together, here's this voter cocktail. One part constructing a personal belief system around the party preferences. One part willingness to do away with democratic institutions that don't produce your preferred policy outcomes. And one part destruction of democratic norms and laws that stand in the way. And maybe an ice cube or two, just to represent how chilling this is. And okay, maybe that's too far, but I do love a good metaphor. So over the past few years, I've been on a concerted mission to understand today's Republican Party, its supporters, Trump voters, and if they're somehow associated ideologically with nationalist movements that we're seeing proliferating in countries other than the United States, places like Australia, France, the UK, the Netherlands, and Italy, to name a few. Three books that I have read, individually and taken together, helped to paint a picture for me that I wasn't really seeing in much clarity. It definitely feels, and I hear this sentiment repeated by many people across many countries and inhabiting many ideological stations, that we are on the cusp of some global shift in social and political order. In fact, perhaps a new world order. In many ways, and especially if we view this narrowly, focusing only on the United States and only through the lens of horse race politics, then maybe it's easy to dismiss what's happening as just heated electoral rhetoric. But if we step back and view this widely, historically, and in aggregate, it's clear that this is a global shift that is cumulative, exponential, and fierce. The anti-immigrant, anti-gay, highly evangelical policy push that we are experiencing in the United States is also happening in places far flung from our backyards, and they echo the same sentiment with the same goals, the demise of liberal democracy. And in that vacuum, these movements are not simply waiting to see if some more authoritarian system of governance fills the gap. They're actively pursuing it. So beginning with this episode, and over the course of the next 3 weeks, I'll be speaking to three researchers who have written phenomenal books that help explain this movement, both in the United States and globally. Next week, I'm talking to Dr. Philip Gorski, a sociologist at Yale University, about his book, co-authored with Dr. Samuel Perry out of the University of Oklahoma, The Flag and the Cross. And the week after, I'll be talking to Dr. Sasha Polakow-Saransky, a journalist and the deputy editor of Foreign Policy magazine, about his book, Go Back to Where You Came From. But first, to kick off the mini-series, today I'm talking to Dr. Arlie Hochschild, sociologist out of the University of California, Berkeley, about her book, Strangers in Their Own Land. For this project, Dr. Hochschild embedded herself deep in Louisiana, Republican, and eventually Trump country, seeking to understand a paradox, why these voters seem to vote against their own interest. And she examines this phenomenon through a keyhole issue, as she calls it, and that issue is environmental policy. In living beside these people, becoming a part of their social networks and families, she uncovers what she terms a deep story that explains what these people are feeling and how it drives their voting patterns, how they connect with politicians and policies, and how they view what, for all intents and purposes, have become their enemies, liberals, and particularly people of color, queer folks, and immigrants. But I'll let her explain the deep story in more detail. Let's do a deep dive. Dr. Hochschild, I really appreciate you taking the time to be here and chat with me today. Welcome.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I think your book, Strangers in Their Own Land, is probably one of the best political science books and some of the best political science research I've ever read. And that's made even more fascinating by the fact that it's not overtly a political science text. You know, this book has received a lot of positive attention since its release in 2016, and I know you've talked quite a bit about it since, but I think that the political landscape and maybe even the people you're researching here have changed so much in the past 6 years. In the last week alone, as a matter of fact, for listeners, we're recording this 1 week after the court overturned Roe and just a day after they ended an extremely consequential term, that, you know, I'm really interested in digging into how this might impact your thinking.
Yeah.
But let's start at the beginning. So in Strangers in Their Own Land, you identify something that you call the Great Paradox. Can you explain what this is, and in doing so, maybe also your central thesis here?
Yes. I start with the idea of how could it be that across the United States, it's the poorer states, it's the states with the worst health, with the lowest education, with the most accidents on the street, the lowest life expectancy, that also are those same states that take more money from the federal government in aid than they give to it in tax dollars. And they revile the federal government, they being people in that state. That's the paradox. If you've got a lot of problems, you've got terrible schools, not enough medical clinics, wouldn't you welcome government help? And generally, these are today are red states. So that was, I thought, I began to that, this is strange, let me go to one of the reddest states in the country, and that would be in the Deep South. And where in the Deep South? Well, that's Louisiana or Mississippi. I knew one person in the state of Louisiana in 2011 when I began my research, and I dove in there to talk to generally white, blue-collar, male petrochemical workers, welders, pipe fitters, to see what their world is. What I did was take my alarm system off and try to enter into what they consider their truth. And it's not a book of reporting. It's a book of translation, because I live in a blue bubble in Berkeley, California. We have our truth, the truth, in my view, and every lot of other people's view. And I wanted to get as far away from it as I could to understand why the bridges between these two worlds are getting so shaky and what was going on the other side.
And so you craft a deep story about these folks, which isn't just capturing the right side of a liberal conservative cleavage, but also the everyone else side of, you know, an elite non-elite cleavage.
Yes.
So what is the deep story?
Well, let me maybe back up and say one more thing about this project. Give it a larger frame. Bring it closer to political science. I think the people that I came to know, if we're to situate them on a social class map, they are the elite of the left behind. That is, from the 1970s on, there have been winners and losers of globalization. And the winners generally have been people in urban areas with college educations on up. And the losers have generally been people in rural situations and without that BA passport. And so in Louisiana, the people that I think were most animated were the most distressed, where I saw the most anguish and volatility were the people who were lower middle class or small business people or blue collar workers who felt, who were kind of the elite, but they felt in a declining world. And the story was one of loss. And I think if we go around the world and look at all the upstart right-wing movements going on today, that's the social class where this begins. So having said that, who do these people, what do they feel? I did develop this idea of a deep story. What is a deep story? Uh-huh. A deep story, again, it's a different way of looking at politics, is a situation as deeply felt. It feels central. It feels riveting. You take truth out of the deep story. You take moral precepts out. It's just a deep story is what is a situation deeply felt. And the right wing deep story that I discovered hanging out with people. I would go fishing with them. I visited their homes, their churches, their graveyards, and kind of getting the hang of their feelings can be summarized in a metaphor in this deep story. You are a blue-collar man and, let's say, a pipe fitter in the petrochemical industry, and you are in a long line which leads up a hill to the American dream as imagined. This line is not moving, and you in line are not looking at the very many behind you in line. You're just looking forward to the kind of guy you would like to be closer up to the American dream. And you feel like you're not prejudiced against anybody. You feel like you're playing by the rules. You've worked hard. At your feet are tired. You haven't had a raise in a decade. And then you see a line cutter. Well, who would that be? That would be an African-American person. That would be a woman who, through affirmative action, that the federal government has initiated, that is taking your place and pushing you back. And that other line cutters would be immigrants, refugees, well-paid public officials. And then you look at the person who is allowing this, it's a federal official. At the time I did this work, it was Barack Obama. And you think, well, hey, isn't he a line cutter too? How did he get to go to Harvard, a guy who was the son of a single mother? Something must be fishy over there at Harvard. And then, so a kind of suspicion sets in. And then in a final moment of the right-wing deep story, there's someone ahead of you in line who's doing better than you are, who doesn't mind all these line cutters, and who turns around, looks at you, says, you racist, sexist, homophobic redneck or hillbilly. Mm. And then you think, I am going into a different line. I'm not this. I'm a stranger in my own land. And it's too much. So the book, Strangers in Their Own Land, is about that feeling. And as captured in that story, I went back to the people I had gotten to know and interviewed repeatedly. And with that story, I said, what do you think? One guy said, you've read my mind. Another guy said, I live your metaphor. And some people said, well, no, you left out the fact that the people waiting in line are paying taxes that are going to the line cutters. So what the metaphor says is that there's a questioning of the whole legitimacy behind the idea of equality, and that their moral ethic, their moral compass does not coincide with the moral compass of liberals. I think that's just the beginning of a story. I would say that we now are the strangers in our own land, because that, you know, with the Supreme Court decision and decision about environmental protection, which paradoxically will hurt blue collar red state people even more than blue state inhabitants. So it's, I think, all the good things federal government has done, protection of gay marriage and Roe v. Wade, all of that is being destroyed now by right-wing judiciary, as we know, and bringing it closer to a right-wing vision of what's right. So it's a discouraging moment, and I have given quite a bit of time thinking about how we got from the Tea Party distress that I saw in 2016 to a full-blown January 6th break-in. And I think actually that you can take the deep story and see various chapters as it evolves. And it's evolved, I think, from a deep feeling of loss. I mean, the people standing in line were feeling, well, whoa, all the economic opportunity that I was hoping for and once had is less than it was because of automation and offshoring, which have hit blue collar harder than white collar. And I've lost cultural centrality. It's, you know, white males used to be at the top, and now we're criticized, you know, as the object of blame for problems. And I think the sense that, you know, I'm a smart person without a BA, that's been demeaned and devalued, that their cultural currency, their cultural capital has been devalued. So a lot of losses, and they love fishing and hunting, but nature's been degraded, partly because they don't believe in the protection of it. So it's a lost story. But I think the lost story has turned into a stolen story. Mm. And stolen has turned into attack the thief. And the people that came to January 6th felt that they were proudly defending democracy and that they were therefore attacking the thief of democracy. So anyway, it's gone through these steps.
Well, I think you're naturally going into space that I'm interested in. You know, I guess over the next few questions, I really do want to delve into what I see as a very dissonant quality to the worldview that the conservatives you've studied here seem to hold, and the objectives they're seeking, and then the means by which they hope to attain it. And so let's just start there then. You know, the Trump candidacy and presidency elevated and legitimized a racial element to the motivation of these voters that I don't think is easily captured in the keyhole issue that you chose to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if the presidency and then now kind of subsequently what we've seen with the court and the Republican Party and the insurrection, if that has changed your views. And you did talk a little bit about loss and then a sense of not just having lost something, but having it having been stolen from you as perhaps being something that's driving these conservative working class voters, or at least motivating them. But I'm wondering, I could imagine feeling a sense of loss or feeling a sense of something having been stolen from me without racializing that. And I'm wondering how that situates. Is it simply the story that folks of color, and I'm following the racial line here, is that folks of color are the thieves?
Yes, I think race, which, as I wrote in the book, people didn't want to talk to me about, you know,
mm-hmm.
It was everywhere I went. I would see flags. I would see, you know, I interviewed Black people for the book, although it isn't about Black people, you know, it's about white people's thinking about Black people. And there were certain areas they would go, and I would see them at a certain time of day walking in Lake Charles at the lakefront. One time of day for Blacks, one for whites. It was all over. Graveyards, you could see it. But they were bottling it up, you know. Some northern writer is coming down. They didn't want to be accused of racism. And I'm not sure that I could have written the same book, had them open their hearts in the way they did, if I started with race. But clearly it was there.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's very overt, I think.
But I wonder what the story would look like if that was a keyhole issue. Let's say we could imagine that somehow that had been attainable, right? To examine that in the same way and maintain the relationships. And, you know, or maybe a keyhole issue being something like white supremacy. How do you think the thesis of the book, not necessarily how it would land today, but at the time in 2016, would be different if you had approached it from that perspective? Do you think you would have come to a different place, I guess?
No, I think I would come to the same place of, first of all, focusing on emotions.
Uh-huh.
And to go back to your question, what's changed in my view? When I started this, I thought I was kind of studying political parties, the Tea Party, you know?
Uh-huh.
Well, no, I think I'm really studying a movement that's more volatile than I had imagined. And it's not just a movement, but it's really feelings that drive that emotion, powerful feelings. One guy I've interviewed since the book said, well, Donald Trump, he's electricity in a jar.
Hmm.
Well, how is, you know, what is that electricity? Let's just stop and figure out why a charismatic leader who in many ways shameless and dangerous, could appeal to what is he appealing? You know, because the electricity, just Donald Trump, it's in his followers. And what predisposition, what are the causes of that predisposition? That is my interest. And I think that they, if you're asking how race, let me go back to race, would it be any different? No, I think that they would fix on race and feel, well, wait a minute, now all of the radio announcers and TV announcers seem to be Black. Many of them are read comics, you know, and are into fantasy. And some of those fantasy figures, you know, this is unsettling for them. And do they know any Blacks, you know, in rural areas? Often they don't. Where I'm doing work now in Appalachia, Eastern Kentucky, they don't know them. And when they do have contact, there's friendship. So it's but if they're in an all-white area, they, you know, project all kinds of feelings of someone's taking something away from me. That is, I think, the quite similar, that loss will be projected onto Blacks. And if you have a charismatic leader like Trump inviting them to blame Blacks, blame immigrants, right? Blame liberal EPA rules and a pinhead, pointy-headed academics. There's a, that's the emotional move between feeling loss and whoa, it's some, something's been taken. And then the next thing, which I think is the, is what Trump has done, is to turn blame, you know, into attack, turn loss into blame, blame into attack. And it all feels like it is electricity and I think that Blacks have become the person that took their place in line.
It's an interesting thesis because I imagine a natural emotion associated with loss is sadness. And a natural emotion associated with something having been stolen is anger, rage.
Yes.
And you mentioned Donald Trump's supporters, and I think that's a great explanation as to that pivot. So perhaps this was primarily a sense of loss, and there was a certain amount of uncoalesced anger, but maybe more so a sense of hopelessness that somebody, and that somebody is Donald Trump, could exploit or at least harness and funnel into rage.
Yes. Instead of feeling abject and depressed and ready for what's been called, you know, diseases of despair, which some in this blue-collar men have been, have a very high rate of, you know, drug overdoses, alcoholism, suicide. That sadness turned inward. And so it can actually feel empowering to imagine yourself proudly defending freedom on the steps of the Capitol on January 6th. You know, you're not an abject victim. You've empowered yourself because, you know, you've made up the belief that you're defending what's been taken. You went for that myth. You went for that magical thinking in order to deal with loss, sadness, and shame.
But so in political science, and you know this, you know, we know that liberal voters and conservative voters are motivated by different things. So liberal voters are more motivated by hopeful messaging, and conservative voters are more motivated by grievance or anger. And Something that struck me in Strangers in Their Own Land is that these are, in a certain sense, in a certain framing, these are two sides of the same coin, in that Donald Trump, in tapping into that rage, was also providing a sense of hope that didn't exist prior.
Yes, oh, very much so. If you look at Hillary Clinton's campaign, there was background music of happiness, you know, I'm happy, happy, happy. And upward mobility, the classic American dream. You just have to work hard enough and you too will rise. You know, there isn't a stall in the line, to go back to the deep story. You know, you just walk ahead to it. And Donald Trump was, this country is a mess. It's been taken over. It's, you know, our bridges are down, our roads are destroyed. We're not what we were. You know, there was a great yesterday in Donald Trump's rhetoric right from the beginning. And so, yes, he appealed to those who were frightened and aggrieved, grieved and aggrieved about downward mobility. And he said, is America great again, right? That isn't saying it's great now. And that was lit the flame. I would say if we focus on Trump himself and how he made an appeal to this elite of the left behind, I think that that story is worth putting in the picture too, because he appealed to this loss. And then I think he made another move, which is to beatify himself. That is, strange as it may seem, he has tried to say, look, I am you, you are me, you love me, I love you, and I am taking your grief on. And I am taking your shame on. And I will rescue you from it. And in a way, he made himself a victim. You know, look how I suffer for you, how, you know, the deep state is against me. And all these liberal pundits, they are against me, but I am representing you. And they bought it. They say, you are my hero. And then he says, I fought for you, now you fight for me, January 6th.
And I wonder if this helps to explain another, I guess, dissonance that I, for a time, struggled with, and that is this. There is a cross-section, or at least a group of folks that make up the supporting bucket for Donald Trump that include, and that is that that is hard for me to square with the rest of the folks in that bucket, and that is Christians. And you talk about, you have in, I think it's your chapter, The Team Player, you introduce the reader to a woman who talks about the fact that she's a Christian and how liberal values don't comport with her Christianity. So, you know, to her, she associates liberal folks with employees watching porn or artists who paint with dung. And it's always struck me that these are the same folks, the folks that are Christians, so strongly support Donald Trump, you know, a man who has questionable values. And
yes,
I'm wondering if your explanation of how he has situated himself as a victim that is taking on their suffering,
yeah,
it helps to explain why, what the appeal is to Christians for him.
Yes.
In that they're not necessarily interested in how things are done,
yes,
but just that they, that things are done.
That's right. That's completely right. They feel rescued by him. And he's not a religious man, as we know. When some Christian leader asked him, what's your favorite book of the Bible? Oh, I like them all, he says.
Yeah.
Right. So he is really making Jesus move move over and trying to become that figure. I also think he is taking over the shame of a shame downwardly mobile social class and saying and taking us through a three-part ritual. So I'll just say this part of a new perspective on this. Not a new perspective, but I'm in my next book spelling this out. But I think during the 4 years of Donald Trump's tenure, we maybe two or three times we were taken through a kind of ritual that none of us kind of saw as that, but it is what it is. This that has three parts. One part, Donald Trump would say something outrageous. All the immigrants, you know, they're rapists and thieves. And okay, so that's part one. He says something outrageous. Or that, you know, Africans all want to come here because they live in hellhole countries. Something outrageous. Then part two, the punditry says, you can't say that. That's shameful. You're a president. What are you doing? How can you say something like that? You know. And then there is a third part where Donald Trump roars back at the shamers. I think the people I came to know get off on that. I think they say, yeah. So that his very shamelessness, which appalls liberals, is actually a point of electricity, point of appeal to people who feel downwardly mobile.
Something I've been struggling with, and it fits, I think, in response to this clapping back, perhaps, or, you know, roaring back.
Yeah.
That so these folks that you've studied are immensely proud people, hardworking.
Yes.
And they have this idea that the country abandoned them, took advantage of them, stole from them, and, you know, that they're being used then to advance people that are less deserving. Mm-hmm. But we've seen, you know, recently the most fervent of them, you know, in support of policies that go much farther than what would seem necessary to meet their concerns. Into like clearly anti-democratic territory, you know, limiting voting, banning books, outlawing abortion now, limiting discussion about sexual orientation and gender and race, et cetera.
Absolutely.
So the objectives of these folks, and I think it seems especially obvious now, you know, post January 6, you know, post election denial, post gutting of voting rights. What I'm wrestling with is it seems like that what their objectives are simply cannot exist in a world in which liberals also get to actualize their objectives.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if this is cynical, and if it's not, how do we reconcile all of this in a unified nation?
You're asking a very basic question. A lot of people that I'm interviewing now are saying, well, this feels like it must have felt at the lead up to the Civil War. You know, there really are fundamental differences. And yet, it's funny, if you hang out with a whole range of people in blue states, as I'm doing in Kentucky now, you find it's not as extreme. They're more moderates. They're more quiet moderates that don't have the microphone. And it's not as extreme as the most vocal of right-wingers are making out. There are many were much more moderate. I think the conversation we're having and your podcast listeners need to hear is that they don't feel any democratic presence that addresses their needs or respectfully reaches out to them. When they think of the Democratic Party, they see an absolute silence on issues of social class, that in the talk is of, you know, trans bathrooms, you know, What about housing? What about the cost of gas? They're not hearing bread and butter issues, and they're not feeling that the economic circumstances of their lives are being addressed. And in addition, they're listening to MSNBC comedians ridicule them. They don't feel spoken to. And it used to be a powerful labor movement was a bridge between the Democratic Party and the blue-collar class. But in the 70s, as capitalism began to do its own thing and wrest itself free of controls of labor unions on the one hand or federal government on the other, and it offshored its factories and capital, that from that moment on, we lost the main connector between a Democratic Party and a blue-collar class, and we haven't made up for that. And the talk has moved to identity politics. Well, you know, gender, race, sexuality, and they think, well, wait a minute, well, what's happened to social class? A lot of the people, by the way, loved Donald Trump, actually loved Bernie Sanders. This is, there are a substantial number who could have gone either way. And I talked to people who said, oh, Bernie, no, he's a socialist, he's a communist. No, but Uncle Bernie. So we're, I think, not being self-critical enough to say, well, how do we seem to them? Who are the people that could hear what we have to say? I think that's the turn the Democratic Party needs to take.
You know, in Bill Bishop's book, The Big Sword, he maps out quite literally, as you know, the mobilization of citizens into like-minded communities. And it creates clear geographic strongholds for both liberals and conservatives in the United States. We both live in liberal strongholds in blue states, blue zones. But I'm also well aware that the ability to change your location, and I suppose by extension, then your condition, is really limited to those that have the means to do so, which means that in real effect, the most vulnerable of our communities are, you know, quote unquote, left behind. And in reading Strangers in Their Own Land, it made me wonder how wise this behavior is. I wonder if maybe it might be better in a lot of ways, political, social, and cultural, you know, I guess irrespective of our personal discomfort and inconvenience, if we, those of us that have the means, liberals and conservatives, instead ceded our unfriendly communities and dove into the work necessary to build more moderate, compromising, and tolerant communities across the entire spectrum of the country. I wonder if, and this has come up in a couple of interviews that I've had with folks, what we're actually doing on both sides, conservatives and liberals, that are fleeing to safer, you know, places are abandoning the most vulnerable in those lands, in conservative and liberal dominions, to their own devices. And what we're really doing is creating a country of vastly different rights and rules and experiences.
Yes. You know, Ro Khanna, who is the Democratic representative of Silicon Valley, has a new book out, which I read and endorsed and liked very much. And he says, look, if you look at all the tech jobs that we have here in Silicon Valley in California, and we're outsourcing some of that work to Bangalore, the work of coding, for example, why not take that to Appalachia and to the South and give people new work there? And I think it's a great idea to kind of reinvest in our own poor and downwardly mobile areas. And that would also bring the liberals, coastal liberals, into the interior of the country.
Dr. Hochschild, thank you so much. I've really appreciated this. Appreciate you carving out the time and having this conversation with me.
Thank you.
After we finished recording, I asked Dr. Hochschild if, to her mind, there was anything shared between the contemporary right-wing voter and left-wing voter in America, some commonality that responsible and responsive politicians and leaders could appeal to that might help to bridge the divide we're experiencing right now. And she suggested patriotism, something that we can all value and hold dear without agreeing on much else, that this is something as Americans that we can all share and respect. And this is absolutely true, that most Americans are moderate. Their policy preferences fall on a spectrum somewhere between the two extremes. The problem is that we have a first-past-the-post-electoral system in which there's one absolute winner and one absolute loser. Think of it this way. If one candidate gets 50.1% of the vote, she wins the entire thing. And the 49.9% of the people that voted for the other candidate lose everything. This design rewards a two-party system, and it rewards extremism in our candidates. A candidate has nothing to gain by moderating. So we end up with extreme candidates that ignore a huge swath of the population. And then the question is the dog wagging its tail, or is the tail wagging the dog? Are these moderate voters moderating their elected officials? Or are the electeds making their voters more extreme? It seems to be the latter, and it's having chilling impacts on the fabric of our democracy. Next week, I go in deeper search of these voters, what's motivating them, and why democracy doesn't seem to be an answer for them, when I'm talking to Dr. Philip Gorski, professor and sociologist at Yale University, and co-author of the book, The Flag and the Cross. In the meantime, as always, if you have any thoughts, questions, or comments, you can email me at deepdivewithsean@gmail.com. And you can find me on Twitter at deepdivesean and on Instagram at deepdivewithsean. Chat soon, folks.